Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. ADD, ADHD, and autism are relatively common brain-based disorders presenting in childhood. Both are quite variable in their symptoms and severity, and treatment can be challenging. On this program, we're going to discuss these disorders as well as several non-pharmacologic treatments, but especially something called neurofeedback. Our guests are Dr. Al Collins, Shannon Isley, and Kathleen Osborne. They are all psychologists with the Alaska Neurotherapy Center here in Anchorage. Dr. Collins and Dr. Osborne are clinical psychologists. And Shannon, if I'm right, you are an educational psychologist.
Psychologist.
School psychologist. Mm-hmm. If you have questions or comments during this next 45 to 50 minutes of discussion, you're welcome to give us a call, ask questions, give us your comments. Let me give you a couple of ways for you as listeners to do that. The easiest way would be our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. We also have an email address, which is line1@alaskapublic.org, and we have a toll-free number for those of you who need that opportunity, and it's 1-888-353-5752. Now, with all those formalities out of the way, just want to say thanks for joining us and helping us understand a little bit more about these disorders. Shannon and Kathleen, it's the first time. Al, you said you've been here before.
I have.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, so let's start with ADD, ADHD. I'm going to ask one of you to help me paint a picture of what we talk about when we talk about ADD and ADHD, so that a listener can help can understand.
Well, it's a trio of symptoms of distractibility, hyperactivity, and what is the third one?
Impulsivity.
Yeah. All based on some difficulty with the executive function of the brain, the front parts of the brain.
Executive function is a term that's getting tossed around a lot now. We're learning more about the brain. That's why we have this term executive function. What happens in the area where we do executive function?
It's mainly an inhibitory part of the brain. It kind of lowers other impulses, controls them. Make sure that they don't happen, they don't get expressed when they're not appropriate. And for people with ADHD, if they're interested in something, if they really care about it, then their executive function may work just fine. But if they're not, then they can't do it, and other parts of the brain take over. They become hyperactive. They express feelings when they shouldn't. They can't control. They can't organize themselves. So really things get out of whack because the executive function isn't working well.
And we know that the different parts of the brains are continuing to mature, particularly in the frontal lobe, is my understanding, mm-hmm. well up into late adolescence and early adulthood now.
Yeah.
So this must be a developmental issue as well, so that if we're talking about executive function in a 3-year-old, it's going to be different than a 12-year-old, which is going to be different than a 14- or 15-year-old. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, it does. It'll look different in each of those ages. In a 3-year-old, it'll look very different than it would in a 12-year-old or an adult. The way that it presents itself is different over the period of one's life.
And in some cases of ADHD, it's a developmental delay, so that the child is behind in the along the developmental course, but they may catch up.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think, Al, you had said something in some of the questions we kind of bantered back and forth, or one of the emails, that I don't necessarily think of this as a disease or any problem. I think of it as a spectrum thing.
Yeah.
And so that it's changing, and all of us are a little different. And when I'm much more interested in reading a book on, let's say, allergic mechanisms, which is a big thing I like, I don't get distracted as much as I'm reading Shakespeare.
Absolutely.
So we all have some variability.
I might prefer Shakespeare, but that's absolutely true. And it's just a matter of more variation. Mm-hmm. People with ADHD show more of a change between what they're interested in and what they're not.
So why is it an issue then?
Well, it's an issue under certain environmental conditions.
Ah.
And there may be times, there probably are times, when it's not a bad thing to have ADHD. It may be that in terms of the evolution of the human species, there were times when that particular genotype was beneficial, like in the hunter-gatherer stage.
Right.
Nowadays, and particularly in school, it's not so easy to live with ADHD. And partly that's because of the ADHD, of course, and it's partly because ADHD is misunderstood widely as being a moral problem, laziness or irresponsibility.
Mm-hmm. But it is a – I'm going to try to echo what you all have said so listeners can understand the way I'm hearing you say it's variable in age, variable in – based on motivation and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But in the right environmental situations, for example, a classroom with a four-year-old, probably a boy, where there are 20 to 25 other kids there, it may be that his problem with executive function and attention and impulsivity is such that he is not successful in that environment, and that mm-hmm. brings on its own group of other problems. And so for that reason, it needs to be addressed in some way. Is that, am I saying that correctly?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. And it it does tend to be worse in school in our experience. It can also create enormous problems for the family.
Mm-hmm.
Because the parents may not understand it also.
Right.
And, of course, it's hereditary. So, you know, we find many families that have several members who have ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
That increases the ability to empathize, of course, because you understand what the child is going through. But at the same time, you don't have the ability to organize your life as well as other people do. And so, mm-hmm. you know, there's a trade-off there.
So, Shannon, as a school psychologist, let me ask you how you think about this issue. Do you think of it as – I've kind of agreed with what Al has to say, is it's probably not a disorder. It's maybe a group of kids that are in this – out there on the bell-shaped curve that are just more distractible than everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
If they weren't in school, there may not be an issue. And once they're out of school, it may not be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I know there's – exceptions to all the rules, and then
right.
it begins to cause problems for educability and self-esteem and
right.
so forth.
So, you know, in the school system, it can be interesting. There are some teachers who, you know, they will expect every student to, we're all going to sit crisscross applesauce, and we're all going to keep our eyes up front, and we're going to keep our hands in our laps. But for the ADHD kid, he might need to be in the back, you know, walking back and forth, or maybe fiddling with some silly putty as he listens.
Mm-hmm.
He might need to, you know, if he uses it appropriately and doesn't have comorbid behavior problems, he could possibly sit on a yoga ball in the back mm-hmm. to have that sensory piece mm-hmm. that kind of keeps him mm-hmm. focused in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are some classrooms that works really well in. And the teacher is okay with that. There are some classrooms where, you know, teachers might be a little bit more resistant to having that sort of thing because it distracts the other kids. And, you know, they might just want everything just so. So that's where the team will get together and meet and say, what can we do? What allowances can we make for this kid who really needs that sensory input?
Mm-hmm.
While he's listening, and to, you know, in home when they're doing their homework and in the classroom, it can look like they aren't paying attention. But when they're done, and you go back and you ask the kid, okay, what did we just talk about? Give me the highlights. He's able to say everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so sometimes it can look like the kid has a learning disability,
mm-hmm.
Or people think that, you know, is he slow? Does he need an IEP, or does he just need some accommodations, maybe through a 504 plan that allows him to do those things like pace in the back of the room while he's listening.
And as a school psychologist, your job is to help figure all the right adjustments for that particular child?
Right. Yes. That's typically what we're called
in
to do.
In a nutshell?
Yeah.
And you use the term comorbidity. Let's define mm-hmm. that a little bit for listeners.
So comorbidity is just meaning there are other things that happen, coexist with that. So a lot of times ADHD might be comorbid with ODD, which stands for oppositional defiant disorder. It's also very comorbid with autism, which is one of my other passions and mm-hmm. areas. And so teasing out the root of what's going on is also very important. Before you start to give recommendations and make accommodations for a kid, it's really important to understand what's at the root of the behaviors that are being presented. Is it ADHD? Is it autism? Is it ODD? Is it conduct disorder? Is it an attachment disorder? There's so many different things that could be going on, and it's really important to differentiate between all of them.
And probably 80% of kids with ADHD do have one or another comorbid
yes.
disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Very high percentage.
And you also sometimes see depression and anxiety as well mm-hmm. as learning disabilities, dyslexia, sensory issues as well.
Yeah. I want to come back to that. Let me just real quickly remind listeners again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guests today are psychologists from the Alaska Neurotherapy Center. We're trying to limit our discussion to ADD, ADHD, and autism. Currently, we're on ADD and ADHD, kind of define what we're talking about. We'd like to get into some non-pharmacologic treatment options with this group of individuals. So if you've got questions or comments along this line, you can reach us at 550-8433-550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. One of the points I try to make with parents who are in talking about the ADD with me is the complexity of all these comorbidities, the terms we're using, but other things that go along. And as Al, you mentioned, Dr. Collins, that many kids with ADD may have other problems. And so if you address their attentional problem, they still may have trouble learning because they have a dyslexic mind. That's the way their mind works. Or they've gotten behind in reading because they couldn't stay on task and right. attend. And once you correct that, things get better. Mm-hmm. And then as they get older, Kathleen, as you mentioned, they're not being successful in school. They may have increased anxiety and depression, which also can contribute to not being staying on task and attention. So as you implied, it can get very, very difficult.
Absolutely.
We talk a lot in pediatrics about attachment disorder. And Shannon, you mentioned that as well. And the only reason I want to bring up attachment disorder is, at least for pediatricians, we're really cautioned about making the diagnosis of ADD before that school-age kid because attachment disorder can look very much like that. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I can. I have, I've had many clients come in and the parent thinks, I think my kid either has autism or they have ADD, and the social piece is really impacted. They'll go up to a stranger and hug them and say, I love you. That's, not something that's very appropriate for a little guy to do to a complete stranger. So that is something that you see in kids who have autism and ADHD, and occasionally, not every single one. Everybody's, like Al was saying earlier, autism and ADHD are both spectrum things, but if it's an attachment disorder, differentiating between those three options, if you will, can be tricky. You really need to get into the early developmental days of the child. That's, sometimes talking to the biological parents isn't an option. Maybe the kid has grown up in foster care and biological parents just aren't around anymore, and it's really important to, as clinicians, for us to take our time, see these clients over a long period of time in different situations, get the school's input, get maybe previous foster care parents' input, and see you know, what the root of the problem is. But, yeah, attachment disorder can definitely present sometimes as ADD or autism.
So the promo that I recorded for the program, which may not have been exactly the most thought out because I was, as usual, in a hurry, I wanted to imply what I said much better at the beginning of this, is that diagnosis can be challenging as well as treatment. And my point is that with all these comorbidities and so forth and the time crunch and the cost, it takes a lot of time to do a very, very, very thorough job. And sometimes, I'm going to say parents, and whether that's right or not, the school, somebody wants an answer pretty quickly and wants things to get fixed pretty quickly. And some of the things we're talking about don't get fixed real easily, and it can take a while to be sure about the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And I've had situations where I've changed my diagnosis, mm-hmm. you know, and said, I was mm-hmm. dead wrong about ADD. This is, you know, depression or anxiety is the primary thing after meeting with the kids a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. You know, the diagnosis can take quite a bit of work. We try to do a pretty thorough one in our mm-hmm. clinic with psychological testing, interviewing, and a lot of rating scales from the parents and the school, both.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. We have a call. I think I'd like to go ahead and take that call, if you don't mind. Is it Bill? You're on line one?
Yes, it's
got
Bill.
To go out.
Yeah, what can I do for you?
Well, I'm aware that many times children with sleep-disordered breathing manifest with hyperactivity, unlike adults that mope around and are tired and grouchy, and it is misdiagnosed as ADHD. And there's actually one study that I'm aware of where taking out tonsils and adenoids has the same effect as putting a kid on Ritalin. About 50% improvement.
Yeah,
I'm curious then, in this situation, if sleep disordered breathing becomes part of a general differential diagnosis in just the form of a questionnaire.
Yep.
You know.
All right, reasonable question. Let's see what our psychologists have to say.
Well, in testing, we do ask about sleep, and especially, you know, we'll see it more with adults that will sometimes come across people that do have sleep disorders, and we ask questions, you know, how long they're sleeping, how often they're waking up, if they're snoring,
yeah.
to give us an idea if maybe there's sleep apnea going on, for one.
It's definitely a very important piece of the process of determining what's going on, for sure.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, yeah.
Because kids shouldn't snore.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure what the study is that you heard, but we see all the time, you know, kids will come in with their tonsils and adenoids having been removed. I've never heard anything, not that you're wrong, that it's, you know, as effective as Ritalin, but it's something that we see all the time, definitely. So taking care of whatever's going on at night is usually a first priority before we do further testing and definitely before we make any diagnosis.
Okay, well, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. You bet, Bill. Thanks for calling. Yeah, I would. I'm going to ask you all to comment on my next comment because I always want to try to put things in perspective. If there's one or two words that I think are really important in medicine, it's perspective. And I don't want, in my mind, you guys correct me if you don't agree. You're not going to hurt my feelings. I would go online as saying if I were to look at all the kids that probably get correctly diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, I don't think that is the most common reason or cause of their attentional problems. I see lots of kids that have lots of breathing problems who don't have attentional problems. Mm-hmm. And I definitely believe that poor sleep makes everything worse. Mm-hmm. And I've seen kids get their adenoids taken out that have ADD and still have ADD. So I don't want everybody running out and thinking that's the problem.
Right.
But it could be a comorbidity.
Yeah, definitely.
All right?
Good clarification to make.
Sometimes I think when we focus on one thing, the listeners begin to think this is the only cause out there.
Yeah.
Dr. Collins mentioned he said it was a genetic problem. I would concur with my understanding is everybody
seem to think that this is an issue that runs in families?
It does seem to have a genetic link to it. And what we often find is that we'll have kids or younger children, teenagers come in and do the testing, and we'll do a Q on them and everything else, and the adults start to see things and kind of like, wait a minute, I was like this when I was a kid.
Right. Yeah.
And that's how they kind of find out that, yeah, right. we have it too.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that gives me a hint to ask, does this problem persist into adulthood, even though we've stated that it seems to be related to parts of the brain called the frontal lobe, and we've already said that that part of the brain continues to mature. So maybe after it's all the way completely matured, there's still some attentional problems that affect life?
Yeah, about 70% of kids who have ADHD will still have it as adults.
Just presents in a different way. Yeah. You know, they're not bouncing off the walls anymore. Instead, they
right. And if they find the right kind of a job, they may actually be more successful than anyone else.
Mm-hmm. What we often yeah. see with adults is they come in and they're very anxious. That's the number one
That's
thing we see with
true.
Adults. That
right.
they'll say they're so anxious and they can't focus and they can't concentrate, and then we'll kind of go from there. And they've often been misdiagnosed throughout their lives.
So that's an interesting observation that I hadn't thought of myself, anxiety. Why would they present with anxiety as an adult? See, I treat kids, so maybe that's my bias here, and I haven't seen that.
Because adults can't get out of their chair every 5 minutes and bounce up and down.
and they've lived with this for, you know, 30, 40, 50 years.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it just kind of wears on you, mm-hmm. particularly people around 50 or something may come in to see me saying they think they might have dementia or something because they can't remember anything and their mind is not working well.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's ADHD that was never diagnosed and that goes along with very high levels of anxiety.
I definitely want to get into treatment, and we're getting already close to halfway through, but so I don't want to break at here and then start doing the treatment. I want to go a little bit longer, but do people with attentional issues always need treatment?
I think it depends on how much it's impacting them. You know, I mean, usually when they come in to see us, it's because it's impacting some part of their life, whether it's their marriage, whether it's being able to, whatever, parent their child or maintain their job. So at that point, they're usually coming in seeking help. You know, that what that help is determined, you know, once we have worked with them for a few sessions and seen, you know, really what's going on in the brain through our testing, through doing, you know, an EEG.
It's the issue is you might want to consider treatment if it's affecting your life, which we hear a lot in the
sure.
psychological approach to things. But it's true in medical, too. Just because you have allergies doesn't mean you need to do anything
mm-hmm.
if it's not affecting you
mm-hmm.
in a significant
yeah.
way. But then there's also a lot of people out there who have it, and it's affecting their life significantly, but they don't mm-hmm. appreciate it or don't want to address it.
Mm-hmm. Or their family is noticing how it's affecting their spouse is being driven crazy by something mm-hmm. that the person is doing because they're mm-hmm. always forgetting or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, and I haven't heard this talked about as much recently, I remember there was a component of ADD that would be talked about was the insatiability. It was people with the attentional problems just they move from one interest to another. But they can never get satiated with that they know enough. I mean, it's that I get interested in a topic, then I move to another topic, and it's like I've heard about people, adults with it, may have trouble staying on the same job because they get bored and they're looking for different stimulation and so forth. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes. In fact, sometimes ADHD is understood to be a reward deficiency syndrome. Meaning that they have difficulty feeling rewarded and they have to stimulate themselves more and more in order to feel satisfied.
Uh-huh.
And that is part of it. But I think the reason that that's there is because of the frontal lobe problem.
Uh-huh.
The frontal lobe can't do its normal job of controlling the expression of impulses.
All right. So we've kind of defined this problem of attentional issues. We haven't really talked about sex differences in boys and girls, but I want to move on and take our break. And I'm getting to the break, and then I want to come back. But what we've talked about is we've definitely got a neurologically based issue.
that is variable. And for many of us in the right situation, we may be somewhat impacted by this, but a lot of times it's not causing us a lot of problems. But one of the things that really makes it an issue in our culture is the requirement to sit still in school for X amount of time. And before people were put in schools, I don't know, let's say 1850 or so, this issue was not an issue. And it may have been an advantage in that issue, I think you mentioned.
Right. Under certain circumstances, it would be.
All right. So let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short 1-minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion on ADD and hopefully have a little time for autism with psychologists Al Collins, Shannon Isley, and Kathleen Osborne. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Okay, welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about ADD, ADHD. I hope to get a little bit of information about autism, but we're looking at the non-pharmacologic treatments in the next half of this program for the most part. My guests are Anchorage psychologists Al Collins, Shannon Isley, and Kathleen Osborne. They all work at Alaska Neurotherapy Center here in Anchorage. If you have questions or comments, email them to me at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us directly during the next 30 minutes or so at 550-8433. And our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And always remember you're listening, if you're listening, between 8 and 9 p.m. on Monday evening. You're listening to a taped recording, and we won't be able to answer your calls or emails at that particular time. I know we have one person holding. I want to talk about just the sex differences between the presentation of ADD between boys and girls. And then we're going to answer the one phone call we've got, and we'll get into some therapy. So we've talked about ADD can vary with age, but we haven't talked about how it may vary from individual to individual, other than in a general sense. But what about boys and girls? How are they different?
So there are three different subtypes. You have the combined presentation, which is what you see a lot, the primarily hyperactive, and then the primarily inattentive. And more often in females, you might see the primarily inattentive type. And these are the people that often get, boys and girls, but more often females, that often get overlooked in school because they're the daydreamers that aren't paying attention. They're not bouncing out of their seats, but they can't stay focused on what's going on in the classroom.
And they may be picked up later.
Yes, picked up
and
the later
they
time.
Get picked up because of...
Well, the ones that are picked up are probably the ones that do have the hyperactive component or the impulsive component. The ones that are just inattentive are often hard to diagnose, and they often do not get picked up until later, like in adulthood.
Yeah. And a lot of times, my understanding at least, is they come to our attention because of failure to meet their academic performances would be expected.
That's what
it?
I was going to say, too, Right. A lot of times parents will start to notice a decline in their grades and what's going on, you know, and they'll try to figure it out at that point, and that might not be till middle school or later.
And we really haven't – another issue about the complexity, and then I'll get off of this, but I just want to – if there's one thing I want to hear people to say, this is not always so simple to really – and it takes a lot of work to really get done well – is that you know, we all come into that classroom with some level of educability and variability in our attention and so forth. And so there's different times when this may come to somebody's begin to be a problem. So some people may do great until high school and suddenly it's a huge issue, or college, or even after college.
Right. And that also depends on their basic intelligence. If they're smart, it doesn't get picked up because they can compensate for the ADD with their IQ. Mm-hmm. And we see a lot of that, very smart people who only get picked up in college or, you know, high school.
Okay. Jan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi there. I have a granddaughter that was at seven was tried to kill herself, or she at least expressed desire to do that. And from that point on, it was just a raging storm until now we're 6 years later and discovering that all through this period of time, where there were some suspicions that she had ADD or ADHD or was on the autism spectrum, she actually had PANS. And the PANS, of course, is an immune system disorder and produces inflammation in the brain and has all whole bunch of other things that are associated with that as well. My concern is that she's, you know, very depressed. Every time she has a flare, she goes into total depression. And a part of that is she lashes out at her mother, mostly. My daughter, and I mean, to expressing a desire to kill her or thinking of some horrible thing that she would like to do to her mother. And I'm just so fearful that something could happen to my daughter as a result of this when she's flaring. And, you know, what to do about that sort of thing. She's now gone through two IVIGs, and we're hoping that maybe that it might reduce some of the flare and maybe she can get her life back to order. But she's 13 now, and you know, going through puberty and, you know, teenage years.
Right.
And so anyway, I'll go offline and listen to your comments.
Okay.
But I wanted to bring in the PANS in PANDAS because I think that's part of it, that it gets all mixed up in the diagnosing of all of it. So
yeah. All right. That's an unfortunate situation, Jan. Thanks for your call. And I'll try to address that since this is probably a little bit more on the medical end. So this is an autoimmune problem that has associated with it some neurologic manifestations, which might be depression, may be ADHD. And this is not the typical ADHD patient, but this is a girl who is undergoing some very substantial difficulties in an autoimmune way with her brain. And the answer to your question is obviously there could be some danger and hazard, and the answer would be in doing all you can to work with the physicians that you have to try to keep this under control. The IVIG is a treatment that is designed to try to knock down the autoimmune aspects of this problem, but it's a far, far different and much more rarer association with the typical ADHD kinds of issues.
But that does raise the question of differential diagnosis of ADHD. And it's true that there are a lot of things besides PANS that can look like ADHD. One of the most important ones is sleep disorder. People who have a chronic sleep disorder may show all of the same or almost the same features as ADHD. Another one is chronic marijuana use and other drugs, which can create some of the same brainwave patterns that ADHD does. So there are a lot of things.
Thyroid issues.
Thyroid disorder is another one. Yeah.
But for any one of them, I would say that they could still seek a therapeutic-type treatment. You know, even if it is PANS, she might benefit from learning to control the changes that are happening in her brain.
So let's talk about treatment. We got a couple of people who have called in and holding, but I definitely want to spend some time on treatment.
And I'll let you guys direct this. I've said that we're going to talk about non-pharmacologic management, and that's fine with me. So where do we go? What are the options?
Well, I'm going to hopefully get some help in remembering all of them because there are so many things that we do here, and we think we need to, but just because it's such a multivarious problem, we try to work with the family in almost every case to help the family deal with the school system because there need to be changes made in the way the kid is educated. And then for the child, there are some things that we can do that can improve the basic underlying symptoms of ADHD. Those would include neurofeedback and working memory training for those who have that problem. Excuse me. Working memory is a problem for about half of the kids with ADHD, and it's very trainable, and, which is why it's important to identify it. So, because if we can find it, then we can prescribe a treatment, which is a computer-based training program that has shown a lot of ability to improve that disability. So neurofeedback and working memory training are like very specific techniques. In addition to that, there's something called mindfulness, which is a technique that's used for a lot of mental disorders nowadays, but it's quite effective with ADHD and essentially means to become aware of the ADHD symptoms and learn how to counter them by self-control and making a decision not to go along with them. Mm-hmm. And if you practice that a lot, that also has been shown to be an effective treatment. So those are all things that we do. Now, in addition to that, there's usually anxiety or social problems going along with it. And quite often, difficulties with self-esteem and feeling with justification, feeling that you're being put down or condemned by others because of the ADHD. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of prejudice against ADHD in our culture. People make it into a joke and pretend that it doesn't exist and then call the people who have it lazy or irresponsible. Mm-hmm. And so the child who has ADHD has to learn how to deal with that. And that's a therapeutic issue. Mm-hmm. So there are, you know, emotional issues like that one, cultural issues, there are family issues, there are school issues, and there are also techniques that will actually change some of the underlying brain dynamics of the disorder.
Just to define something real quickly, working memory, there's various kinds of memory in our brain. The working memory is that memory that we're working on when we're taking 100 and subtracting 3 and then we're subtracting 3 from that answer and 3 from that. We have to kind of keep things in the forefront doing it. And many kids mm-hmm. with attention deficit issues have trouble with that particular thing.
Yeah.
So that you can help train that. How much does that training of improving working memory help the underlying other impulsivity, attention issues? One aspect?
That's a good question. Probably working memory training mainly helps working memory, but working memory is such a fundamental cognitive skill that if you are better at that, then you're going to be better overall. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, it probably also helps academic performance a bit, you know, probably okay. not as much, though, as it does working memory itself.
Shannon, I'm going to put you on the spot since you came in with a 9,652-page book on neurofeedback. I don't know how you could carry that thing when you walked in here today. What's neurofeedback, and how does that thing work?
Okay, neurofeedback is, you know, it's pretty cool. It can be intimidating, I think, when people first see it, you know. And if you Google it, you know, you'll see pictures of this person with a cap on their head and a gazillion wires coming out of it. And that can be quite intimidating. But you can use anything from, you know, a 19-channel, which means there's 19 what do we call them?
Little, electrodes.
Yeah, electrodes on the cap, monitoring the brain waves. Or you can use as little as one.
Mm-hmm.
And the one channel typically works well with the little guys who are hyperactive or the autistic mm-hmm. kids. But basically, it's a way to retrain the brain. The brain is like a muscle, like, you know, if you think of it in that way, where the more you go to the gym and work it out, the stronger it's going to get.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that we do this with the brain is it could be a video, it could be a game that they're playing, but they're controlling it with their mind, which mm-hmm. when you explain
right.
that to kids, they,
right.
you know, it will get them to kind
right.
of buy into it. And
right.
and it's important to say, too, that nothing is going into the brain. These sensors on your head are reading what's going on in
right.
the brain. They're reading your brain waves.
Right.
And then the point of the game or movie, like I said, is to keep the movie going. And if the movie dims, or if the sound dims, or the screen starts to go black, that means that you're not producing the brainwave that we want you to produce.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point is to, like I said, either create more alpha or create more theta in some cases. It depends on which mm-hmm. what we're training in, what Brodmann area we're training in the brain.
So these are well-accepted kinds of waves you see on a typical EEG, electroencephalogram,
mm-hmm.
that
right.
physicians would use to diagnose seizures or other learning or other neurologic problems.
That's right. And we always take an EEG first.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's the part we kind of jumped over is that we do the EEG, the 19-channel or a single mm-hmm. channel, and we're looking at the brain waves in different areas of the
mm-hmm.
brain.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're too slow in some areas, then they need to be speeded up. And they're too fast in other areas, they need to be slowed down. So
mm-hmm.
we're trying to find a balance mm-hmm. in certain areas of the brain that will help with behaviors.
You know, this technique is based on the basic fact of neuroplasticity.
Yes.
That the brain is able to change with exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems like also very akin to biofeedback.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It grew out of the biofeedback
yeah.
world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I remember years ago at an Academy of Pediatrics meeting where you were sitting in front of a screen and you could control this balloon and make this somebody like a balloon that people ride in
mm-hmm.
kind of balloon. And based on your controlling your blood flow on your finger,
yeah.
you can make this balloon go up and down.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
you are controlling it. The indicators mm-hmm. or what's doing it is through your finger, though.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
I guess you're kind of slowing your pulse rate, doing various things. But you learn to control it. So basically, you're training a person to control certain brain waves by the activity, by giving them some kind of feedback mm-hmm. about the waves
right.
that you're seeing.
And so the feedback, and I can expand on that a little bit if you want, but just because that's another confusing part for people, is that the feedback that they're getting is that the screen no longer is black and white, or they can now hear the violin playing. That's
mm-hmm.
their feedback. That's a
mm-hmm.
and to most of us, we don't really consider that feedback per se, but you know, an example might be when a child is learning to tie their shoe and she looks up at her dad and her dad smiles,
mm-hmm.
meaning she's doing the right thing. You know,
right.
her brain automatically
mm-hmm.
says, oh, hey, I'm doing it right.
Right.
So there's, you know, it's your brain learns to do it the same way that your brain learns to ride a bike or your brain learns to tie your shoe.
Right.
Your brain is pretty fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't
way.
Have to try.
Yeah.
Just get out of the way and let your brain learn how to do this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cognitive behavioral therapy is a key word that I haven't heard brought up. Where does that fit in? And is it a valid approach?
The way that we understand it, cognitive behavioral therapy is an essential part of what we do, but it's part of mindfulness.
Okay.
Mindfulness is being aware of what your brain is doing, but then doing something about it. And the things that you do about it mainly fall into the area of cognitive behavioral therapy, like learning how to stop impulsiveness, making a decision not to do it, recognizing that you don't have to go along with everything your brain tells you.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that is really cognitive behavioral therapy.
And that's an important part that we always incorporate, too. We don't just hook people up to sensors and
sure,
let them go.
Sure,
we use a lot of the mindfulness
right.
and the therapy goes along
right.
with it. Yeah.
And I guess, in a sense, you pick and choose the therapies based on the comorbidities and age and all this kind of stuff.
Correct.
It has to go into the fact.
That's right.
I had a couple of people holding for a while. I'd like to go – and one email, so I'd like to go ahead and try to address those. I have a call here that's about ADHD gender, if I've got it right, or ADHD gender, and the caller wants to be anonymous. Can I ask you to ask us your question?
Hi, I'm calling in because I'd be a perfect Citigroup family because we all have ADHD and I have mine, so I'm anonymous. And it was really hard to wait, but there's no differences that I've seen in my children that are now 18, a female 18 and a 14-year-old male. I was diagnosed with ADHD in the 80s, and they told my mom to give us coffee because we didn't have health insurance, because there wasn't health insurance for the indigent back then. Geez. Anyway, so I was brought up on coffee for my ADHD, and it does exhibit itself differently. Mm-hmm. My son would get hyper-focused as a baby and do repetitive things and get hyper-focused, whereas my daughter, I had to be her entertainment coordinator. And by the time she was 8, I was like, I am not your entertainment coordinator. You have millions of things to do around here. I've bought all this art supplies. I've gotten games. I got video. I got everything for you. But that's how the difference is. She was red flagged in kindergarten. They were like, we don't know what's wrong with her. She's not, we can't hold her back because of her grades, because she's intelligent. But there's something that we don't get. Mm-hmm. And it was ADHD. Mm-hmm. But the Adderall, it dumbs her down. Mm-hmm. It works opposite. It slows her down. People think she's depressed on it.
Right.
Rather than her boisterous, chatty self.
Yeah.
So seeing the gender differences growing up, the cognitive training, I believe, works. I really do. And medication helps me kind of feel not anxiety, because stimulants work differently on, like, chatty mm-hmm. people. They make them quiet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I think they're good if you'll take them. She won't take them, and I never made her take them. I made her try them for like 2 weeks, I think, in high school, and she's mm-hmm. like, people think I'm depressed. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm sorry, then you don't have to take them. I'm not going to make you take something that makes you feel look
right.
depressed.
Right.
Socially, you know, you look depressed now because you're not chatty, but but my son still, he's not super hyperactive. She is.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with me. I'm hyperactive, talk fast. She gets louder when she talks. And it's cognitive training, though. I want to tell her, but she's at that sensitive 18-year-old age. Like, hey, when you get loud, when you're excited, you just have to not be so loud. But it's just cognitive. You can train yourself. What I'm interested in is, because I'm like a dual survivor of sexual abuse and I think I have post-traumatic, and I want to do the EMDR treatment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because of the trauma that I saw, I think that I can train my brain to have positive responses maybe to my anxiety. And I think my anxiety is partially ADHD. And then panic attacks I've had, they've manifested into panic attacks when I was like around 18. So it's just dealing with that on a daily. But I just wanted to make a note. We'd be the perfect steady family because it does exhibit itself differently genderly.
Yes.
And lateness for males, it's timeliness. And lateness, mm-hmm. maybe more so, mm-hmm. not being cognitive time. Mm-hmm. And that does mess with relationships, you know?
Yes.
So people think you don't care or you're being disrespectful. Whereas I train myself with a watch, you know? I'm like, I cannot be late to the movie, even the previews, because it makes me have anxiety to be late.
Yeah.
So see how it can exhibit itself differently in people.
You're a perfect example of the complexity of this problem.
It is. It is very complex. Yeah. And I can see why people are drug intolerant, because it does dumb you down, drugs, and people don't want to be dumbed down. They want to be who they want to be.
Right.
You know, their genuine self, you know, in life. They just need tools to, in cognitive, I think, I say kudos to cognitive.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Got an email. Says, my husband is undiagnosed with ADD, so I have to say I'm not sure what we got, but that's what she says. He has recently become the sole breadwinner, and his symptoms have increased dramatically, anxiety, impulsivity. How do you go about finding a life coach and cognitive behavioral therapist who specializes in ADD? Regular counselors seem to speak over his head and make him feel guilty.
Mm.
So there's some complexity here about what's really going on and some other issues, but he's... suddenly things have gotten worse. I don't know his age and so forth. So she's looking for help. Where do we go?
Come to us.
Yep. We've got your website is on our website at Alaska Public Media. Mm-hmm. You might want to go ahead and give us a phone number if you know it off the top of your head.
It's
907-344-3338. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that's one potential answer to that question. Sounds you're right. If the problem is ADD, you may do much better getting to somebody who does that a lot for a living. Mm-hmm. Let's take another phone call. Allison, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi there. Good afternoon.
Howdy.
I was calling with a question about the comorbidity or overlap between ADD and ADHD and trauma, developmental trauma or childhood trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you guys could maybe speak to that.
Okay.
To sort of, you know, symptom overlap. And
right.
I was also wondering if that's something that is included in your screening process when you're trying to figure out what's going on with someone.
Okay.
And I can take my answer off there.
All right. Thanks for your call. It's a very interesting question.
Yeah, we do see that quite a bit. And our evaluation process includes a really comprehensive look at, you know, especially, well, whether you're young or you're old, we like to look at what was going on in your early childhood days. Was there trauma? Because, like you said, trauma disorders can sometimes manifest like ADHD and ADD. There's so much going on in the brain of somebody who has experienced trauma, whether they're a child or an adult. You know, you can't focus, can't control your anger impulses. You know, you're anxious all the time because of, you know, possibly the trauma that happened to you. It's definitely something that we look at in our evaluation process.
Yeah, I like to put a little bit more medical spin on that. When you're young and you're exposed to a lot of trauma, your whole and the other thing I want to remind people about our brain is a great learning organ. It's not a good unlearning organ. You can't tell me how to unlearn how to ride a bike. So if early in your life you're exposed to a lot of trauma, your whole fight or flight system is upregulated. Mm-hmm. You are going to get distracted very easily. You're watching what's going on around you quite a bit, and so that can appear and or complicate the underlying problem.
Exactly.
That's the way I think of it, and that's much more medical approach. But it's the same idea,
right.
I think, that you were saying.
That's exactly right.
So hopefully that will answer that question for you. I've got a editorial bias or question because I'm the host. Mm-hmm. I have noticed recently, maybe for several years, I've been noticing that a lot of kids that I see with attentional problems often have more likely they're more creative.
Yes.
They're more likely to be the artsy guys. They're the musicians, the writers, and even the scientists, because science is all about solving problems creatively.
Yep.
So I don't see, maybe I don't read enough, but that's my observation.
Yeah.
You see the same thing.
Yes, it's been my observation for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're creative and intuitive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's good and bad about everything.
Absolutely.
And these
guys. It's not all bad, and that's one of the things that kids with ADHD need to learn about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a difference. Mm-hmm. It's not a disability.
Good point.
Same thing with autism.
And it's so important for people to find something that they really love and for adults to go into career paths that they really enjoy, because then they can focus on it. And the other positive thing, the hyper-focus ability that people with ADHD often have, they can block out their entire universe to zoom in on something that is exciting and interesting to them.
Yeah. It's kind of follow your bliss to some degree kind of idea, unless you're a musician. Anyway, I won't. It's hard to make a living.
There's a lot of people in the music industry, a lot of athletes,
absolutely.
A lot of people with ADHD.
Yeah.
And probably a lot of Alaskans, people who come up here, you know, may have a more likelihood of having ADHD.
Got another question that came in by email. Can you please discuss auditory learning disability? What would happen if someone had that as well as ADHD? So this is the question about auditory and visual processing and ADHD. You're the school psychologist, so tell us about that.
Yeah, we see that and hear that a lot in schools, and it's come up, you know, it comes up in private practice plenty of times as well. So, you know, there's a lot of different therapies out there for auditory processing disorder. There are people who specialize in it, you know, where you would go in and they would use things like music and different sounds and to help the person, you know, either learn how to use them to their advantage or, you know, control their focus better.
Yeah. It can be difficult to distinguish auditory.
Very difficult, yes.
Yeah, learning disorder from ADHD. Mm-hmm. Part of it is because different professionals deal with these things. The auditory learning disabilities are not likely to be something that psychologists specialize in, but we need to know about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and the tests that we give will sometimes, and you know, find that a person has both. Mm-hmm. You know, that the ADHD and auditory learning disability are both present.
Yeah. This is another little nuance, and that is that we all kind of have our subspecial interests and way of thinking about things. And so it's the old, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And,
exactly.
everybody we see is not just the same kind of nail, and we need to be able to identify these little nuances.
Yeah.
And it may take a speech therapist to be much better at this auditory processing kind of issue. Than,
that's right.
And we do make referrals for that, too.
Yeah.
Speech therapy and auditory therapy.
I have someone holding, but we're really in our last couple of minutes, and I'm going to have to apologize and not be able to get to that call. I like to end up with just a couple of comments. People, whatever comes off the top of your head about what you want our listeners to remember from this this program. Shannon, what would you say to that question?
Yeah. You know, I think it's important to remember that, you know, whether you think that either you or someone you know or a loved one has one of these disorders, I think the important takeaway is to not be ashamed, not let other people, you know, talk down to you about it or look at you differently, because like Al has brought up several times, there are so many great traits or attributes that people with autism and ADHD have that really make a good contribution to society. The ability, like we've said, to hyperfocus, that's something that both autistic people and ADHD people have. So that's just one example of something. Their creativity, you know, my heart goes out to people who are spoken down to or have come up against individuals in society who just either don't have the patience to deal with people who have these disorders and really look down at the deeper issue of what's going on and help them train themselves to be aware of when they're exhibiting the negative aspects of the disorder and focus more on the positive. So.
Al, just a couple of seconds. Anything you want to add to that?
That ADHD is something that can be treated, and actually it's probably more treatable than a lot of mental health disorders.
Yeah. Good point. Kathleen, we got 20 seconds.
Yes, kind of what they said. And, you know, if you think that it's going on, to get checked out. And a lot of people with ADHD and these disorders are very, very intelligent people that have a lot to offer, but they get kind of put down.
Don't think of it as bad. I tell kids all the time I can't sing. Fortunately, I don't have to go to school and sing all the time. But if I had an attentional issue, it may be a bigger issue because I have to go to school every day. All right. So my thanks to our guests, psychologists Al Collins, Shannon Isley, and Kathleen Osborne. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
And if you want to continue this discussion, you can join KSK on Facebook. You can find that link at www.alaskapublic.org, where you can also find the Line 1 archives. On the next Line 1 program, our co-host Prentice Pepperton will once again address a pertinent mental health issue. Why don't you join the discussion next Monday, October 17th at 2 p.m. right here on Alaska Public Media. My thanks to Ron Zastro, who is our audio engineer today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.